Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Kirk Hansen, Professor of Ethics and Executive Director of the Markkula Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University, and your moderator for today's program. Tonight's program is part of the Charles and Louise Traverse series on ethics and accountability. It's now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, James Stewart, New Yorker magazine contributor, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, whose latest book is Tangled Webs, How False Statements Are Undermining America. James Stewart was born in Quincy, Illinois, and is a graduate of DePaul University and the Harvard Law School. He joined the New York law firm of Cravath, Swain, and Moore, but was quickly drawn into the world of economic and legal journalism with the Wall Street Journal. There he wrote extensively about the 1980s insider trading scandals and the 1987 upheaval in the stock market. These articles won him a Pulitzer Prize and led to his noted book, Den of Thieves, recounting the criminal conduct of Wall Street figure Ivan Boesky and junk bond king Michael Milken. He has continued to be one of America's most insightful economic and legal journalists. He's published books such as Blind Eye, The Terrifying Story of a Doctor Who Got Away with Murder. In 2005, Disney War, on Michael Eisner's reign at Disney. Amongst his books is one book on The Partners, which is about America's most powerful law firms, and another on The Prosecutors, on how the government's most prominent lawyers really function in our legal system. He has been a contributor to The New Yorker, has been an editor-at-large for Smart Money Magazine and SmartMoney.com, but he told me just before we began this evening that he will be moving on to The New York Times, writing a front-page column in the business section on Saturdays, starting in a few weeks. He is a teacher, a professor at Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism, where he holds the Bloomberg Professorship. Please welcome James Stewart. I'll start the questioning and then work your questions in as we go. Jim, delighted to be with you.
Thank you. I always enjoy being here at the club and in San Francisco.
With all of the, if you like, ethical problems in business and in government and in private life in the United States, why did you choose in this book to focus on the problem of perjury?
Well, I had done a lot of writing and reporting on a lot of the corporate scandals that started unfolding really after the dot-com bubble burst and then just seemed to be coming at an ever-bewildering rate. You know, WorldCom, Enron, Adelphia, Tyco, et cetera, et cetera. And I kind of kept wondering, well, what is the common thread here? And then, of course, more recently, the financial crisis began to unfold with some very similar behavior, but very disparate actors up and down the system. And it was kind of, I was actually giving a talk about these events one day when suddenly it dawned on me that the common element in all of these scandals is lying, false statements, false financial statements, false mortgage applications, false mortgage brokerage representations, false packages of mortgages, lies from the rating agencies. I mean, it just went on and on. And suddenly once I saw the lying in the financial area and the losses it was causing people, I naturally began to see it everywhere, you know, in Hollywood, in sports, need I say, in Washington. And it kind of just dawned on me that someone needed to put these pieces together, stand up, and explore why this was happening. Even more importantly, what the consequences are, and then, of course, what we can do about it.
Is perjury different from general lying in society?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think we all know that lying runs the gamut, from the innocuous white lie, even the lie that you could say is sort of a moral imperative, to the most severe cases of lying. And so not to get into any of these gray areas, I focus only on the most severe kind of lying, which is criminal lying, which is lying under oath, which is lying to government agencies engaged in the investigative process. So this isn't even about lying in press conferences. It's certainly not about lying to your spouse, which there seems to be ample amounts of. And speaking of which, I decided...
Perhaps that's your next book.
I decided... well, I basically decided not to write even about perjury cases involving sex, of which they're rampant. And by the way, any judge, I've heard from many judges since this book came out, and people who preside over divorce courts said the perjury that goes on in there is just unbelievable. But the most egregious case that I probably decided not to include was John Edwards, who was a presidential candidate, I mean, and of course a vice presidential candidate on the ticket, who actually induced his top aide to file under oath a false affidavit attesting to the fact that he, the aide, was the father of John Edwards' child. Now, could anyone even make this up? If I made something like this up, I'd be laughed off this stage as being it would be implausible. Anyway, so I moved sex off the table. That still left many, many candidates, and I ended up with these four.
And what leads to your belief that perjury is more common, lying is more common in society as a whole today?
Well, there are no actual hard statistics on this. I mean, right now, no one could tell you how many perjury cases there are, let alone how many perjury cases didn't even get prosecuted. But anecdotally, every single prosecutor I spoke to said, it's bad, it's getting worse, it's reaching a crisis proportion, we don't have the resources to deal with it, something has to be done about it. One prosecutor in particular, I remember, said, I come to work every single day, without exception, expecting to be lied to. The only question is, how good are they at it? Will I be able to make a case? Will I be able to maintain an investigation despite this lying? But he said, it is a given that the lying, and criminal lying to an official investigator, is going to take place. And I just feel that anecdotally, it's rampant, it's happening more and more often, there are more public cases of it. And it's no wonder when you think about it, and this is one of the reasons I chose these cases, when you have people at the pinnacle of their fields. These people are role models who are doing the lying. There are people that other people look to in society and emulate. So is it any wonder that when you see people like Martha Stewart, Scooter Libby in the White House, Barry Bonds in the sports field, Bernie Madoff until he was exposed as a fraud, these were people that many, many people modeled their behavior on. And at the very pinnacle of the system, I'll be nonpartisan about this, we had two presidents in a row. We had Clinton, who committed perjury, only grudgingly acknowledged it, has never really apologized for it. And in his successor, President Bush, we had not only the rampant lying that I document in the Libby case, but then when Libby was convicted of not just lying in a press conference, but taking the oath and repeatedly lying to the grand jury, President Bush commuted his sentence so that he never served a day of the 3-year term to which he was sentenced. That, to me, sends a message that we're condoning it. One of the most startling things I uncovered in doing this was that on the eve of the Libby indictment, a United States Senator, Kay Bailey Hutchinson, went on national television and said, well, if they're going to indict him, I hope they get him on a, quote, real crime and not some technicality like perjury. And, you know, this is a United States Senator. I mean, hello, perjury is a felony. It always has been in this country from its founding. It was a crime in medieval England. It was a crime in the Roman Empire. It's in the Ten Commandments. It is, I think, a fundamental plank of civilization. And yet we have high-level officials who are doing it, condoning it, dismissing it as a, quote, technicality. So is it any wonder that there's a lot more of it going on?
Well, let me just test that a little bit. There is some strain of thought which would say this is no big deal, that lying in court to protect yourself is merely part of the game, and that You're naive to think that there's honor or virtue in telling the truth if it's going to get you in trouble. How do you respond? And I suspect that's part of our culture at the moment.
Yeah, well, let's think about this for a moment. The legal system, and I hadn't really focused on this until I started on the book, but it really is based on an honor code, which is that every citizen called to testify will hold up their hand, swear to tell the truth and nothing but the truth, and then, in fact, take the witness stand and honor that oath. Perjury was originally prosecuted in medieval times in the ecclesiastical courts because to violate that oath was considered a crime against the deity, that the oath was a pact between God and man that could not be violated. We don't have to be religious to see the importance of this to any functioning legal system. We if everyone in mass decides, I'm going to ignore that oath and say whatever I want, or whatever I find to be my immediate self-interest, we can't have prosecutors and law enforcement people standing there every single time someone takes the witness stand, or we'll have nothing but perjury prosecutions to the extent we even have the resources to pursue it. So that code of honor, you may call that naive, but that is a fundamental element of our civilization and the rule of law as we know it. And I think it's not naive because it's not just some simple honorable ideal. It has real practical benefits that have been hammered out over centuries of human experience and learning the hard way what the alternatives are to a rule of law. I mean, I frankly have been somewhat astounded, having written this book, to have quite a few people sort of ask the question, well, what difference does the truth make anyway? And why is it so important? You know, why shouldn't people believe whatever they want? And it's kind of thrown me for a loop, but I mean, at the extreme, I keep wondering, well, maybe they should go back and read Animal Farm. History is filled with, you know, horrific regimes, totalitarian regimes that are built on lies. And how many examples of this do we need for people to learn how important the truth is, the fundamental importance of truth is to any society that wants to call itself civilized?
There are some who would argue, and there are some professors at the university where I am now, who contend that part of our problem is lying by the prosecutors, and that indeed the increasing prevalence of hiding of evidence and playing games on the prosecution side is partially to blame for the kind of pattern that you see. How do you respond to that?
Well, the four particular cases I zero in on do not focus in major part on misconduct by prosecutors. But why would we think prosecutors, and by the way, lawyers and judges, would be any different from anyone else in society affected by the same forces? We're all human beings. We all model our conduct in different ways by looking to people. I think lying by prosecutors is particularly serious. I mean, the first line of defense against perjury has to be the legal profession, prosecutors and judges. And if they begin to fail, then it's an even greater crisis. But yes, there is lying by prosecutors, and it doesn't surprise me. It has to be dealt with firmly and harshly in the same way we deal with it with others who do it. And by the way, in my book, in the Martha Stewart case, there is a very, I think, poignant story where there was this young fellow, Doug Fanuel, who was the assistant to Martha Stewart's stockbroker, who was 26. He'd been at the job 6 months. He wanted to please his boss. He didn't want to offend the office's biggest client, Martha Stewart. So he went along. He misled them. He omitted material information. And then they said, you've got to go take an oath and testify to the grand jury. And he said, I mean, almost alone among the characters in this book, he went back and said, I cannot do that. Based on my training and my family and my schooling, that is a line I will not cross. I will not put my hand up and swear to tell the truth and then fail to do that. So he changed his story. He was honest. The whole house of cards came crumbling down. The process by which he reached this decision, I think, is really very interesting and moving in the book. But instead of, he basically then had the book thrown at him by the prosecutors. Mm-hmm. And much to his dismay, he's finally telling the truth and getting these lies off of his shoulder. He felt the prosecutors were now pressuring him to go to the other extreme and to say things that he didn't believe were true in order to help secure the convictions of his bosses. So you do see the pressures on everyone in the system, the short-term advantages they sometimes see to lying. And, you know, the prosecutors, again, I think they backed off. He didn't have to lie, but he was maybe a little too idealistic in thinking that he would be safe once he decided simply to tell the truth.
And in the quote about Doug Fanuel, he said it was okay, he felt it was okay to lie to the prosecutors on the phone or just meeting them in their offices, but not under oath. What was
right.
it that was so different about being under oath?
Well, I think the oath, thank goodness, had meaning to him, as I would hope it would to all of us called to testify. I mean, doesn't every child in America learn the phrase, I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? I think that's very important. And to him, that was part of his upbringing. That was part of his inner moral compass. Mm-hmm. His conscience could not tolerate that. Mm-hmm. Somehow, you're right, the circumstances of being on the telephone, dealing with SEC investigators, even though every time he was warned that it was a crime to give false statements or even to withhold material information, mm-hmm. he could do that and live with himself, although it became increasingly difficult. And this is kind of jumping ahead in the story, I guess, but I think the Fanuel story is so important in this book, in the context of the book, mm-hmm. because You can argue about whether, you know, Martha Stewart came out fine from all of this. She's still a celebrity. She's still rich. Barry Bonds still has his home run crown. Scooter Libby's working for a big think tank and still being, you know, protected by Republican operatives. But Doug Faneuil has something precious, which is his own sense of self-worth and his own integrity. Mm-hmm. And I gave a talk like this at the 92nd Street Y in New York a few weeks ago, and somewhat to my surprise, Doug came up afterwards. He was in the audience. I didn't see him. And he said, you know, I've been struggling with this for years. And he said, I read the book. I've been thinking about it. And I'm glad I did what I did. I'm glad I didn't keep lying.
Mm-hmm. Let's explore the reasons you think this has become more common and that the truth is more elusive in American society. What do you put your finger on as the top couple of reasons why this is more common?
Well, you see a fascinating array of forces at work in these main characters' decisions to, in fact, violate the law and lie. And I was headed into this reporting, frankly, mystified by the decision of these characters to do what they did. They all seemed to have it all. They were at the pinnacle of their fields. They were wealthy. They were well-educated. They were role models. They were business leaders. They were political leaders. Why would they risk all of that by lying under oath? So that was my sort of fundamental question. And I figured they were probably the least likely people in society to be lying, unlike, say, some street criminal pulled over and said, oh, did you just sell a bag of marijuana to this guy on the street? And they, of course, lie and say no. And interestingly, I've come 180 degrees around to the opposite point of view, to the belief that many people who are very successful, wealthy, are probably more likely to lie in these circumstances. And the reasons go to why they made that decision. One of the big ones that you see there is that they're surrounded by people who I would call enablers, who never stand up to them. You know, they can make the most preposterous statements, and everyone around them flocks around to say, oh, yes, you know, right, Martha, right, Scooter, mm-hmm. you know, right, Bernie. You know, I'm thinking, right? I mean, doesn't anyone have any backbone in these stories? No one ever tells them what they don't want to hear. They've, in many cases, cut corners before and gotten away with it. One of the most shameless examples comes in the Madoff case, where lots of people wonder, well, how could he have gotten away with this for so long? And you see with all these people that one of the reasons they get away with it, what they do for so long, is that no one ever calls them on it. In fact, other people help them. So Madoff is under investigation. The SEC, hapless though it was, and you know, weak-spined though it turned out to be, actually at one point did start calling some of his clients, which would very quickly have led to exposing the whole Ponzi scheme. So they call the biggest feeder fund, this Fairfield Century operation in Connecticut, a big hedge fund that just passed all of its investments over to Madoff. All of their income came from him. And so what did they do when the SEC came knocking? They immediately called Madoff and said, oh, guess what, Bernie? The SEC is investigating you. And then Madoff gets on the phone. His opening line in the conversation is, this conversation never happened. So, you know, which I would have thought would have been a red flag. On this call from Fairfield Century was the general counsel, a lawyer, and the chief risk officer. They're having the conversation. Mm-hmm. By the way, we know the conversation happened, and you can read it word for word in my book because Fairfield Century recorded it. The reason they recorded it is Madoff talked so fast that they couldn't keep track of his notes. So they had a rule that whenever Madoff called, they'd put the recorder on. So the whole thing was tape recorded. And it's astounding because Madoff is on there, and he basically dictates to them what they should tell the SEC. And they just nod and say, right, Bernie, yes, of course. He says things that are contradicted by written documents that they have. They never challenge him on it. They turn around. They give the information that he wanted to the SEC, so much so that the SEC people themselves said, well, they must have been prepped because he's saying exactly the same things that Madoff did. Anyway, it's just shameless enabling cooperation. Is it actual conspiracy? Well, that'll remain to be seen in the various lawsuits about it. But it's appalling behavior on the part of people who obviously had a financial interest in keeping this golden goose laying its eggs. And there are many examples in this book that I think are so interesting because, you know, let's face it, I think most people are people of goodwill. They want to be law-abiding. And you must deal with this in your ethics course. It's like if you ask someone point blank, would you lie under oath? Like, oh, no, I'd never do it. But then in the real world, you see it comes up, the need to lie comes up against other values. And then they're all too willing to lie if it means their financial interest at stake, if loyalty to someone wealthy and powerful trumps the obligation to tell the truth, as it does repeatedly in these stories, and I could give you many examples of it. So they live in an environment that is very conducive to cutting ethical corners all over the place, and certainly when they see it as in their interest, telling lies.
So if it's greed that leads not wanting to turn Madoff in because it would cut off our sorts of funds, or loyalty. Ironically, loyalty we've always taught as a virtue, and yet you're arguing that it actually is one of the things that leads to this kind of perjury?
Absolutely. Loyalty surfaces over and over again in this book as trumping the need to tell the truth. And we all know that loyalty is cultivated as a virtue, and loyalty can be a virtue. In many cases, it is. Mm-hmm. But when virtues collide, people have to decide what has to take precedence. And a great example of the loyalty issue surfaces in the Barry Bonds case, where his personal trainer, Greg Anderson, there's very significant evidence that he routinely injected him with steroids. He was his chief supplier of steroids. He had these calendars in his house that indicated on which days Barry Bonds would take this steroid and which on that and which wouldn't be detected by the tests, et cetera, et cetera. Initially, when questioned, he lied and said, oh, no, I gave steroids to many athletes, but I never gave them to Barry Bonds. Then, when called before the grand jury under oath, he had a lawyer. He refused to testify. He was given immunity, which means then you have to testify. He still refused. He was put in jail several times for contempt of court. On one of those occasions, he was released from jail. All the prisoners gathered around and gave him a standing ovation. And I thought to myself, you know, that pretty much says it all. Mm-hmm. This is the code of the prison yard, where the code of silence takes precedence over the obligation to tell the truth. This is the law of organized crime. This essentially is the law of the jungle, because when loyalty trumps the obligation to be honest and to tell the truth, what happens is people who are in a powerful enough position to command loyalty are therefore in a position to suppress the truth. And that means they maintain their power. Why did Scooter Libby lie in the White House? Out of loyalty. Why did people lie in the Nixon White House? Loyalty. Loyalty trumped the obligation to tell the truth. And essentially, if you see in every one of these cases, by the way, loyalty only runs in one direction. It only runs from the weak and the less wealthy to the powerful. I mean, as I say in the book, what loyalty did Barry Bonds ever show his trainer, who went to jail for him? Why didn't Barry Bonds say, look, I'm innocent, I never took steroids that I knew of, and Greg, just go testify. I don't want you and your family to be ruined by this. So go testify. Tell the truth. I think it will exonerate me. Did he ever say anything like that? No. On the contrary, when questioned in the grand jury, and this quote is in the book, I'm amazed this hasn't got more attention, he basically said, look, I've made a lot of money. There aren't many black rich people in this country. I'm not giving it up. And by the way, I'm going to use my friends if I can. Mm-hmm. It's kind of breathtakingly candid given the rest of the lying that he did.
One of the questions from the audience asks about our winner-take-all society. Has this contributed where the rich get quite rich? The Barry Bonds salary is many times what any other ball player is,
yes.
And so on. Is that something that is driving this perjury, the willingness to protect that star status no matter what?
Absolutely. And I think that's part of it. We do have this sort of winner-take-all mentality, and we want perfection from the people we have put up on a pedestal. And it's a two-way street. So again, part of the reason that these people lied, even though they were so celebrated, is because they were so celebrated, they didn't feel that they could publicly acknowledge even the slightest flaw, or they would be knocked from the pedestal and they would be dismissed. They would no longer have the adulation of their public. I mean, Martha Stewart is an extreme example of that. She was offered the most lenient plea deal in white collar crime history. And initially, she said she'd take it, would have had no jail time, a slap on the wrist, but she had to admit that she'd lied under oath. And then and by the way, I think the fact that she was ready to take that deal indicates that she knew that she was guilty. 45 minutes later, she had her lawyers call back and say, no, wait a minute, I can't do that. I cannot, my business cannot tolerate any flaw in the Martha Stewart image of perfection. Now, the prosecutors didn't think it was her business. They thought it was Martha Stewart, couldn't tolerate any flaw in her image of perfection. But you see the other characters well. I mean, Barry Bonds, had he been honest in the grand jury in 2003, presumably he would have had to stop taking steroids at that point, and he would have been under a cloud. Although other baseball players who admitted it went back to playing, but he probably never would have won the home run crown. And so to him, I think it was worth it. It wasn't enough. You know, he would have just been another kind of average, successful pro baseball player, but he wanted that pinnacle. He wanted it all. And the same thing with Bernie Madoff. He had a perfectly successful, legitimate business, but it wasn't enough in the world that he lived in. He had to be a mega billionaire. He wanted to be on the Forbes list. He wanted to have 3 yachts, 4 country club memberships, 6 houses, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
One of the questions asked about Lance Armstrong and the current discussion around steroids or around blood doping and so on. Do you see that as one more example of wanting not just one Tour de France, but wanting 7?
Well, I'm not intimately familiar with the evidence in that case, but the signs are not good. The Lance Armstrong case is heading down the same path as Barry Bonds, Marion Jones, Trevor Graham, Tim Montgomery. Have we heard this before? At least I haven't heard him say that it was flaxseed oil, which, by the way, if you are using steroids, stop using the flaxseed oil alibi. It's been repudiated too many times. So I don't think it's looking good. And, of course, it is very disappointing. We want people to be heroes. We do. But I don't think that means we can close our eyes and ignore the fact that, look, people are human beings. They may have flaws. And, by the way, there is room for redemption and forgiveness. I don't want to stand up here and get up on my high horse and say that these people should be condemned to the outer circles of hell for the rest of their lives. But I've always was taught to believe that the first step towards forgiveness and redemption is to be honest about mistakes that you've made. Thank you.
Thank you. There's a wide variety of questions about why, other questions about why the rich and powerful are the way you describe. And one of them relates to a theory you presented in the book, Martha Stout's theory, that the rich and powerful are risk takers, and that risk takers take risks in all aspects of their life, skirting close to the edge, whether it's sexual behavior or fraudulent behavior or whatever. Where do you come down on that finally?
Well, I know I totally agree with that. I think they are risk takers, and when you think about it, they actually enjoy the risk taking. They get adrenaline out of it. They get some excitement out of it. And when you think about it, lying and getting away with it is a form of risk taking. I mean, I can't resist telling one anecdote. I mean, to pile on Martha Stewart, but sometimes it's these little stories that I think speak volumes about sort of risk-taking, a willingness to be honest, to cut corners, and haven't gotten away with it in the past. But she lied in the course of an insider trading investigation in which she had traded shares just before an adverse announcement in highly suspicious circumstances. But it happened while she was on her private jet flying to a post-Christmas holiday at a very luxurious resort on the tip of Baja, California. And she took her best friend, Mariana Pasternak, along on this trip as her guest. So they were at the resort, and as she was going through the lobby one day, she bumped into this New York billionaire financier, Steve Schwarzman. And when she came back from the trip, she submitted an expense report to Martha Stewart Living Omnimedia, which, by the way, is owned by the shareholders, not Martha Stewart. And she billed the entire cost of the trip 100% as a, quote, business expense. And she wrote on the form, business conference with Steve Schwarzman. Now, I was very suspicious that 2 days after Christmas, you're having a business conference with Steve Schwarzman. I know him, so I called him. I said, did you have a business conference with Martha Stewart? He said, well, we said hello to each other in the lobby, and that was it. Then, that wasn't enough. She'd already been gotten all of that money back, something like $17,000. She had her accountant call her friend, Mariana Pasternak, and said, you have to pay your fair share of the trip. Now, I don't know how many thousands of dollars Mariana Pasternak had to cough over, but I'm sure she thought she was there as Martha's guest. But that means Martha Stewart was double-dipping on her vacation trip, getting reimbursed more than once for it. So the sort of rich irony of that is that when the trial comes around, while they were at the luxury resort, Martha Stewart made the rather indiscreet comment to her friend while sitting on the balcony that, isn't it nice to have brokers who tell you things, referring to the inside information she got from her stockbroker. So this was pivotal testimony, and Mariana Pasternak was called to the witness stand. Now, she claims that she went through deep anguish over whether she would have to tell the truth and betray her dear, dear friend Martha Stewart. So after having had to pay her share of the trip, guess what she decided? I'm going to tell the truth. So little Mariana Pasternak, the Connecticut realtor, got her revenge.
To carry this to the extreme, you described Bernie Madoff as a different kind of case.
Yes.
Whose entire life was a lie.
Yes, completely. Everything about him was a lie.
Are those people different than the Martha Stewarts and the Barry Bonds and the Scooter Libbys?
Well, they're way more extreme. I don't know. I'm not a psychologist, so I can't tell you who's a sociopath and who isn't. But he's sort of way over on that psychiatric extreme. Because sane people do not, first of all, put themselves so much at risk. And while fleecing, thousands of people of billions and billions of dollars. Mm-hmm. But
including the university he sat on the board of.
The board of charities. And, the myth of Bernie Madoff for all those years was that you had to be very wealthy. He was very selective about who he would let into the fund. So I read every victim letter in the court file. And to my astonishment, these people weren't wealthy, and he wasn't selective. He'd take money from anyone who would give it to him. An elderly widow is brought into his office, and he puts his arm around her. He takes all of her money and says, "Don't worry, dear, I'll take care of you." And immediately sucks the money away into his Ponzi scheme. That's just unbelievably appalling. There were firemen and policemen and middle-class people who really, of course, they weren't, sophisticated investors. They gave all their money to him. They lost it all. But the reason that Barry Bonds figures so prominently in this book is, again, I thought, how he led a Ponzi scheme. And, Ponzi schemes may be big or small and come in different guises, but they're all the same. They're Ponzi schemes. They've been around forever. We know what they are. My question was, how did he keep it going for over 20 years? And more to the point, how did he survive four SEC investigations over that period? So I figured he must be one of the greatest liars in financial history. Mm-hmm. So I looked at what his testimony was. I did a Freedom of Information Act request, so you can see the actual quotes from him testifying under oath. And to my astonishment, he was a terrible liar. He was one of the worst liars in the book. And the SEC knew this from the very first time they investigated him. The low-level people, the lawyers questioning him, were hopping up and down saying he's lying under oath, he should be referred to the Justice Department for a perjury case. These recommendations ascend the management ranks of the SEC, and the higher they get, the less interested anyone is in pursuing this. They're shrugging and saying, kind of like the U.S. Senator, like, "Oh, well, perjury, everybody's doing that, it's like we're about securities fraud, so maybe it's just a false statement." Again, completely ignoring the fact that this is an independent crime. And that, by the way, people don't lie to investigators just for the fun of it. They're always covering up something. Mm-hmm. It may be criminal or not, but it's something that they are trying to hide. And wouldn't you think they'd want to get to the bottom of what it was he was lying about? And though these cases kept sputtering out, I got so upset writing this chapter. At times, I had to get up from the keyboard and kind of walk around and take deep breaths because the dereliction of duty is so so disappointing.
We're here discussing the book Tangled Webs with James Stewart, author and Pulitzer Prize winning author for his book Den of Thieves. There are a number of questions which relate back to this moment of truth or crossing the line, mm-hmm. that you describe in the book, the moment at which someone decides to perjure themselves. Do you think there's some specific characteristics of that? Is there a way of perhaps helping people who are in that moment of truth?
Well, yes. This goes to some of what can be done about all of this, but I think a lot of it has to be... First of all, as the Doug Fanuel story illustrates, the foundations of his moral fiber were established in his family. Mm-hmm. And I think everyone has a role to play in that regard, that these models, the original role models are people's parents, their siblings, how this is dealt with in the family context I think is very, very important. And everyone can reaffirm a commitment to trying to stressing the importance of truth, mm-hmm. and where it fits into the hierarchy of competing values in the family unit. But in the education system, what you do, I think, is so important. Ethics course is important. Weaving ethics issues into other courses as well, not treating it as an isolated instance, and especially trying to, which I guess you have some experience mm-hmm. doing, get away from, it's important to know what's ethical and what isn't ethical, but what's fascinated me about all of these examples of lying is that everybody knew they were doing it. I mean, they knew they were behaving unethically. They knew they were violating the law, and yet they did it anyway. It's because of the competing values that they decided that it was worth it to lie. And I would hope that kind of reading these stories would help people recognize that all of us are going to be faced with complex situations where forces are going to be leaning on us to say something untrue or to go along with someone else who's saying something untrue, and we have to be prepared for that moment when it comes. Now, that said, all of these characters clearly had thought about it ahead of time. It wasn't like on the spur of the moment, in a sudden panic, not expecting the question, they just decided to lie. They all had lawyers sitting there. They had been on notice in many cases they were going to be testifying. Some of them had already given preliminary statements. Scooter Libby had already been warned that nobody backed up his story, that there were none of the corroborating witnesses agreed with him, and then he still went forward with a lawyer at his side, digging himself in deeper and deeper.
There are a couple of hypotheses in the questions. One is bad parenting. Do you think that is, does a lot of the blame for this fall on, I hate to say it, my generation and my parents' generation, that we just simply have not raised our children with the values?
I think that is a problem. I mean,
Thank you, moving along.
I can just give you an illustration. While I was page one editor at the Journal, we did a front page story. Our bureau chief, I think, in Pittsburgh wrote it. And it was about a very prominent high school in Pittsburgh that had a record of placing many of its students in very good colleges and universities. And at the graduation ceremony, the valedictorian came across the stage, and everyone in the class booed, because they knew he had cheated, and they knew that his parents had intervened and put pressure on the teachers to go back and change his grades, and the teachers did it. And the parents were at most at fault in there, meddling with the school system to get their kids these high grades, and in some ways were probably more to blame than the students themselves. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's just an appalling example. That story set off a huge reaction, because we got so much comment from people who said there were similar instances like that at high schools all over the country. Parents who were obsessed with the end result, they didn't care about the means, they were determined to get their kids into prestigious schools, and they would stop at nothing to do it. Now, that obviously is a problem. What are those kids, how are those kids going to have some kind of moral compass when they face these dilemmas later in life?
Mm-hmm. There are quite a few questions regarding comparisons to your cases in the book. And given your success with Den of Thieves, how do you compare Madoff and some of the other people you're seeing in the current generation to the criminals or the bad actors of the 1980s?
Well, the one thing that was different about the insider trading ring that I wrote about in Den of Thieves and its links to the SNL crisis is that it, unlike this, it did seem to have, there was a finite group of characters. Mm-hmm. They didn't all necessarily know each other, but they were kind of concentric rings that were linked by various activities, and you could see, you could kind of get your hands around the whole thing. Here, I began to see this behavior kind of like cropping up all over the place without anyone, there was no common set of characters. Mm-hmm. So that was one difference, and that's when I began to think that it wasn't just one or a handful of people who came up with a cunning scheme to get ahead and then drew others into the ring. There was something much more systemic that was at the root of this problem. Now, I did say, I was actually, somebody handed me a copy of Den of Thieves the other day and pointed something else I wrote there, which was that, you know, the good thing about what happened there is that the insider trading was rooted out, people were prosecuted, there were sentences, it was deterred, and at least for a while it seemed like insider trading was, you know, a thing of the past, that junk bonds, you know, revived, and the illegal conduct of that had pretty much been stamped out. But I did say, I'm sorry to say this turned out to be true, I said, history gives us very little comfort that even though there's been a short-term benefit from here, that we're going to deter similar behavior in the future. And given the speed of the sort of news cycle these days, it'll probably be sooner than we expect, and it'll be in a different guise. It won't be junk bonds, it will be something else. Mm-hmm. So what it turned out to be, you know, mortgage-backed securities, whatever. But it's the same sort of behavior that you see regenerating. And a lot of it, I think, was because, of course, once the problem was all out of the headlines, you know, the pendulum swung the other way. Prosecution stopped. Deterrence stopped. We had, you know, when Bush came to power, he openly said, oh, I think that, you know, the regulators have been too hard on business. We've got to make it easier for business to flourish. The SEC has to be, you know, not so hard on Wall Street. And, you know, you take the police away from the scene and the criminals move right back in.
So do you see this as a never-ending cycle that we'll tighten up for a time? We're in a tightening period?
It's why we can't dissolve the Justice Department. Yes, it's never-ending. I mean, you have to have deterrence. You have to have prosecutions. You have to have meaningful sentences to deter other people from doing it at one extreme. And at the other hand, you have to have people of goodwill and good character, all of us out there, being mindful of the values that have made this nation and our society great and trying to reinforce them at every opportunity we get. Mm-hmm.
A couple of people have asked or commented about the people who are in leadership positions, government leadership position, not just presidents, as you cited earlier, but Congress, which can't seem to police its own members at time or doesn't take seriously some of the egregious cases through investigations. Is there a problem of modeling by our most prominent leaders, our heroes, at least government heroes in those cases?
I mean, absolutely, I think that's a problem. I mean, I don't feel that in my own life I've had a, you know, tremendous amount of power to wield or something, but I did have a management position at the Wall Street Journal. I was the page one editor, and I decided what went on the front page, and there were all the reporters were trying to get on there. And one of the paradoxes of having that power that I discovered was I had to be much more careful about using it than of the minor powers that I'd held before. The paradox of power is the more you have, the more careful you have to be about its exercise because it can so easily seem unjust or inequitable. And I'm afraid there's so many people that never seem to learn that lesson, and so they abuse the power that they get. And to me, having that power, having that authority, part of the restraints that you have to exercise is setting an example for other people who are looking to you to be fair, to be honest, to treat them fairly, and they depend on that. And some of our top officials, I think, have lost sight of that. I mean, I feel the Obama administration could do a tremendous amount of good by reaffirming the importance of truth in our culture and society and in the legal system, by getting the Justice Department to pursue some high-level cases. I mean, the financial crisis seems to me a perfect example. People keep saying, well, we can't find any crimes here. Where are they looking? I mean, how many false statements were made in the course of this crisis? It's all, the whole house of cards was built on false statements. Many of them told either under oath or in official context where lying is in fact a crime. I would like to get in there for a few months, and I guarantee you that I could come up with some cases. So I think we need people to reaffirm this.
There's a question about Berkshire Hathaway and the recent discussion there. To what extent is that one more symbol that the supposed heir to the founder of Berkshire Hathaway is not able to tell the truth, or at least is not able to fairly trade?
Well, absolutely. It's a wonderful example that happened after I finished the book because, I mean, here we have in Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway the pinnacle of ethical behavior in American business. And by the way, the Berkshire Hathaway code of conflict of interest policy and code of behavior is a model. It's fantastic. Among other things, it has a blanket statement that says, if you have any doubt, question authority about it, and don't do anything that you wouldn't want to read about in the front page of a national newspaper, which I've always found as a reporter is a pretty good test for something that you're thinking about doing that you think you might get away with. So here we have David Sokol, that apparently the heir apparent or a leading candidate to succeed Warren Buffett, who engages in what to me looks like brazen insider trading on the knowledge that Berkshire Hathaway might acquire a company that he then bought stock in. He, at best, is misleading in his comments to, far from following the code and disclosing it and telling us and checking with his superior to see if it's okay, he arguably misleads Warren Buffett. But then, much to my amazement, Warren Buffett himself, when confronted with the behavior and evidence of it, seems like a deer in the headlights. He himself, who I guess wrote and certainly approved the code of ethics, didn't seem to realize that it violated 6 different prescriptions in the code of ethics. And when announcing his departure, says, oh, we don't think anything, any wrongdoing. I'm very reluctant. You know, I'm so sorry he's leaving because he wants to spend time with his family. By the way, that's like the flaxseed oil of corporate behavior. You know, and people should stop abusing the family. Every time they say, oh, they want to stay more, spend more time with their family, I know that there's criminal behavior.
Because
I remember the Enron guy, the president of Enron, Jeff Skilling, when he resigned, they said he wants to spend more time with his family.
We're here talking with James Stewart, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, and the author of the new book, Tangled Web, about perjury in America. One of the questions asks about our trend in society to be more and more legalistic. And is talking more about legal, illegal, and the line between the two, is that weakening our sense of being able to think about right and wrong no matter what the law says?
Well, I think to some extent that's true. And you see a lot of this in perjury cases because you have to prove that the statement is false. You have to prove that the person making the statement knew it was false at the time. So you get lots of dancing around, like, well, what does this word mean? I don't want to revisit the whole what does is mean, you know, from that sort of thing. But you get lots of that kind of parsing of language, you know, which I think somebody should just say, you know, this is ridiculous. We all know what you mean. We're all speaking the same language here. And, you know, this slicing words down in these peculiar ways isn't going to get anywhere. So I think there is too much of that.
The question about dealing with this, is the answer codes of conduct in companies? Is the answer codes of conduct for professionals like lawyers and accountants and engineers and so on?
Well, if you're going to have the codes, you've got to enforce them. And one of the things I looked into in working in the book is I was very struck by the fact that all these lies took place with lawyers sitting right there who, you read these stories, you want to tell me they didn't know these were lies when they were said? They were incredibly blind and stupid if they didn't realize their clients were lying. And in a few cases, you see in this book, lawyers themselves lie to the court. But you see them sitting there letting their clients lie. I think this is a huge problem in the criminal defense bar. But I went to law school, and I reviewed the Code of Professional Conduct, and it is a violation of the code. The code says that a lawyer may not knowingly allow a client to make a false statement under oath or in an investigative process. Mm-hmm. It's in every state code bar of ethics, and it's in the model code of ethics. So I ask, okay, so who's ever been brought up on this? Who's ever been referred to the ethics panel of the State Bar Association for allowing a client to lie? No one could cite a single example to me. It has never been enforced. The criminal defense bar seems to take the view that if you are not 110% certain that your client is lying, then just let them lie. I mean, one of the most egregious examples is in the Martha Stewart case. She's one of the, as far as I know, the only person in history who was convicted of lying for saying, I don't recall. Because, I mean, Vice President Cheney says, I don't recall virtually every single question. Like, what did you have for breakfast this morning? I don't recall. And he was never charged. But Martha Stewart, her stockbroker left her a message about the stock that was going to go down. And she was notified that she was going to have to give testimony. She called the lawyer. She hired lawyers. The lawyer said, we want to see all your email messages from the day that you sold the shares. She had her secretary get the emails up on the screen. She came out. The secretary is looking at them, and there's this message that says, you know, from Peter Bukanovic, your broker, M-Clone is going to trade downwards. Mm-hmm. So Martha Stewart grabbed the mouse. She erased the message. As everyone knows, this was obstruction of justice. This is destroying evidence. So she went back into her office. She called her son-in-law lawyer, told him what he did. He said, oh, for God's sake, get that thing back on there now. So she went out. She asked the secretary, put it back. The secretary says, well, I don't know how to put it back. They couldn't put it back. They floundered around a little bit. They couldn't put it back. So she went back into her office. This is a Friday that this all happened. Mm-hmm. She testifies on Monday. The prosecutor said, did you get a message from your stockbroker about M-Clone systems on that day? With her lawyer sitting there, Martha Stewart says, I don't recall. She had just spent the entire weekend discussing this message with her lawyers, and on Friday, she had erased it. She didn't recall. How could the lawyer sit there and, you know, why didn't they say, Martha, do you need a bathroom break, or we better talk about this, and then come back in and correct this testimony? How could they not do that? And yet, they let her say that. And that was one of the counts that she was convicted on.
Okay. There are several questions about the change in the way we communicate, that we communicate by the internet, by text messaging, by blogs, by anonymity. Do you feel that the internet is changing our allegiance to the truth because we can hide behind anonymity and flame about others and make accusations online?
Well, that's a good question. I haven't really thought about that, but it only stands to reason to me that there's going to be more false statements made if someone can hide behind anonymity and doesn't have to stand up for it. I mean, that's one reason you put people on. You make them put their names on things. And I think there have been a lot of recent disturbing cases where, you know, teenagers get on and make, you know, terrible allegations about various people on the internet without revealing who they are. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably likely, but I hadn't really focused on it until now.
Mm-hmm. To get back to the whole question of parenting, as some of the questions do, what would you recommend for dealing with the first time your child lies, or for a teacher with the first time, exams are coming and grandmothers are dying right and left as people are not able to get their papers in, and usually that's the most common reason in university life is grandmothers dying.
Well, this reminds me of a story I told Diane Rehm when she was interviewing me a couple weeks ago. I was in the second grade, and I came back from the lunchroom, and there was a girl in the front of the class. Everybody was gathered around and was all excited because she said that a dime had been stolen out of her desk during the lunch hour. I have no idea what came over me, but I must have been, like, jealous of the attention she was getting, because I immediately said, well, I had a dollar stolen during the lunch hour. This was completely fiction. I had never even had a dollar in my entire life. And this false statement was all too effective because the classmates immediately abandoned her and rushed to me saying, my God, a dollar, I can't believe it, as the teacher walked in. So she said, what's going on here? And they said, Jimmy had a dollar stolen during the lunch hour. So she started questioning me more. This is when I started realizing what a tangled web this all is. She said, well, what were you doing with a dollar? And I said, well, my mother gave me the dollar to do the family grocery shopping after school. Digging the hole ever deeper. At this point, she grabs me by the collar. We go to the principal's office. The principal calls my mother. And I'm sure she thought they're thinking of her as being at home smoking and drinking, sending her second-grade child off to do the grocery shopping. And, of course, she said, you know, that's absolutely false. He did not have a dollar. He is not doing the grocery shopping. I collapsed in tears, begged forgiveness. I was sent home. And my mother wasn't unduly harsh. I was confined to my room to reflect on what had just transpired. And then I was sent back to face the humiliation of my classmates the next day. And that was all. I wasn't spanked or I didn't have my dinner withheld from me or anything like that. But it made an indelible impression on me. Mm-hmm. And the burden of carrying that false statement and then having to make it worse by lying on top of it made quite an impression on me. So I thought she actually handled it quite well. But I wonder today, would in the elementary schools, if a teacher came back and found that a second grader had made up a fanciful story to get attention, would she be as firm with that? Would she have taken me by the collar and taken me to the principal? And would the principal have gotten on the phone to my mother? I hope so. Mm-hmm. But I've heard from plenty of people that they feel in the schools today probably this would have all been just pushed under the rug, and they would have said, okay, sit down, kids, and let's get back to, you know, whatever Dick, Jane, and Sally, whatever we were doing before lunch.
Mm-hmm. Let's go more to your solutions, and there are a number of questions asking for more about what you would do. What should we as a society do? Should we demand of our courts that they prosecute more cases of perjury? Should we demand of our prosecutors that they do that?
Well, I think as individuals, it's not easy to demand of prosecutors to do anything or judges to do anything. But we can vote, and I think we need to start voting for candidates who show at least a fundamental commitment to the truth before we get to any other issue, before we even care about their political affiliation. That to me should be a baseline issue.
Is there a way to tell? Because a lot of us supported John Edwards and Arnold Schwarzenegger and others. Can we really tell about our candidates?
Well, not always. But, I mean, the problem is when I think John Edwards, we can safely say, has ruined his political career. But there are any number of people I mean, did anyone look very closely at Donald Trump's record of truth-telling before he's suddenly getting all this attention as a possible presidential candidate? I don't think so. I mean, people have short memories. There are plenty of people who have been running for office who have been, you know, shall we say, challenged about honesty in their past, and I don't think that should be swept under the rug. But I do feel we should also demand of our leaders that they address this issue. As I said, I mean, and in my book, I call on President Obama or any president, I'd like to see it in the State of the Union address, a recognition that this is a fundamental premise of our society that has been under attack, that needs to be reaffirmed, and there are going to be cases brought and prosecutions made, and that there will be deterrence. I mean, I wrote this book in large part as a kind of cry to say to people that we've got to wake up about this and recognize the problem and do something about it. And I'm happy to say that I've heard from judges. Some of them have come on the air, even on shows, to say, you know, you're absolutely right. We've all been just kind of like thinking it's too big of a problem to deal with. We've got to deal with it. A federal judge told me she had given 40 copies of the book to all of her former clerks. I've been invited to speak at several judicial conferences, which I'll do, because I think the judiciary is definitely a front line defense, because they see it happening all the time, and they are in a position to do something about it. I think the Attorney General should bring some cases. As I said, I think there are plenty of possibilities in the financial crisis to start with. We need some high-level prosecutions to deter it. And then throughout society, I think we all have a part to play, which is to reaffirm our own commitment to honesty, to try to lead honest lives, to be aware that we're going to confront issues in the workplace, in the family, in the schools, where we have to stand up for the truth and have the courage to do it.
Mm-hmm. One of the issues that corporations face frequently is whether one small omission on a resume or one small misrepresentation on a resume should permanently bar that person from ever having employment with the firm. And there are different views on that.
Well, I think the punishment should fit the crime, but I certainly, working many years ago at the Wall Street Journal, I remember there was an issue of plagiarism that surfaced in a fairly senior level reporter that was admired by many people on the staff. And I mean, once I think he was treated fairly, but when the evidence was pretty compelling that he had committed plagiarism and then, more to the point, had lied to his editors about it, he was gone. He was out. I mean, there was a very, very firm commitment to ethical behavior there, and there was real punishment for people who violated that. I mean, they were fired. Mm-hmm. And that really did make quite an impression that behavior was not going to be tolerated in this workplace, and there was, like, zero tolerance for dishonesty.
And other institutions could do the same thing.
I think so.
In
I mean,
society.
A minor omission on a resume, I don't know. You know, like Doug Faneuil, who we mentioned about, had to testify in the Martha Stewart case, and on cross-examination, of course, they tried to destroy him and his credibility. And I think they found on his resume he had a 3.7 grade point average, where in fact he had a 3.68. And they were hammering on him, saying, oh, you're dishonest, or something like that. And the jury, you know, I think rightly threw that out. So there are, you know, trivial misstatements. I mean, that could be a rounding error. I don't think it's a false statement. So
a couple of people asked about lying for a higher purpose. Well, are there cases where lying, obviously for national security, is one that comes up once or twice in your book? Are there a set of cases where lying for a higher purpose is justified?
I think there are. I mean, one thing I learned in law school is that there's no law is absolute. There's probably an exception to virtually everything. And the example I use in the book is if you're the Dutch family that's harboring Anne Frank and her family in the attic, and the Gestapo comes knocking on the door and says, do you have some Jews upstairs? I think the moral imperative is to lie and say no, even though it was a crime in the Third Reich to give false testimony to the Gestapo. But Cicela Bock, whose book I quote on lying at the end of the book, did a very trenchant and rich philosophical study of lying and the context in which it takes place, and actually made the argument that the cases in which lying is justified or where it would even be morally imperative are, in fact, much fewer than most people recognize. They are very rare.
Mm-hmm. Okay. As you come back to giving recommendations to this audience or to young people, what can we say to a group of young people like we are here today about what to do about this in their own lives? Is there a case to be made for telling the truth always, even at a cost to oneself?
I think absolutely there is. And I think Doug Faneuil, again, is a good example of it, because He experienced what it was like to live with a lie, to have to carry that burden of lying, to know that he had committed a crime, to know that he had been misleading people. And he couldn't live with himself. He could not enjoy life having made that significant moral compromise. And I think it takes some experience, maybe, and our role models have not been very good. But I don't think we should aspire to lead a life of superficial success at the price of inner failure. Mm-hmm. That people who are morally bankrupt, have no inner compass, who may nevertheless achieve a certain level of wealth and fame, that is not a life that I want to imitate. I don't want those benefits at that cost. That I think we need to reaffirm that a rich and full and fulfilling, satisfying life starts with having respect for yourself, having inner integrity, and reflecting that in everything that comes up in life. Mm-hmm. And if that is the governing force, I think many other forms of wealth will accrue to these kinds of people in terms of rich relationships, of being admired, of having a positive influence on others' life, mm-hmm. of being able to give to other people, that is so much richer and more satisfying in the end than being a billionaire or flying on a private jet or being able to get the best table at some restaurant. And, I mean, that's a message I would try to... That's what I've experienced in my life, and I would hope that there would be many other people who would affirm similar experiences.
Thank you. There are a couple of dimensions we haven't discussed in our hour, and one of those is the international dimensions. You focused on four cases in the United States. Mm-hmm. Do you have any views about whether lying is more prevalent abroad, less prevalent abroad, whether this is a global phenomenon that you're watching of the increase of perjury or lying? Or
well, I don't doubt that it's a global phenomenon. I think it's pretty basic in human nature. And I've felt that for all of our flaws here, that, you know, America remains a beacon for most of the world. And one reason we are is that we are a nation of laws, not men. That is one of the most powerful, that's what's embedded in the American Constitution. That's what's animating, you know, the revolutions in the Middle East. And that's what I think people of goodwill aspire to all over the world. And this essence of a law, of being a nation of laws, is the obligation to tell the truth when questioned. I mean, there are societies that don't even pretend to be a nation of laws, where I think lying, corruption, bribery, they're rampant. And I think there are recent studies that actually showed that those nations never seem to get above a certain level of prosperity, that they are like permanently lodged somewhere about one-third to two-thirds lower per capita income than the United States. So there are both tangible benefits from the system that we have, and I think even more importantly, the intangible benefits of living in a society that we know it's not perfect, but at least we aspire to fairness and justice and equality under the law.
Mm-hmm. As we move forward, we're unfortunately down to the last couple of moments of our hour together. And so let me ask a final question that may help all of us, and that is, how do we prepare ourselves for that moment of truth, that moment where we may be tempted to lie, where we hopefully will not be in a perjury case, but where we may indeed enter into the dark side? What can we do as individuals that will prepare us for that moment?
Well, I think, first of all, to know that it's going to come sooner or later, absolutely, each and every one of us, and to think about, you know, I sometimes look back on that second grade experience and think about, do you really want to make that choice to lie and then live with yourself afterwards? And I'd hope the answer would be no. So when that happens, the instinctive reaction is, to be honest, not, in fact, to cover up, to go along, or to lie about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There are a few more questions. We have just a couple of moments more. Let me focus finally on the question of your own work for the New York Times, the column that you're going to be writing. Are you indeed going to be writing about lying and the business world, or what will be the focus of your new column?
Well, it's a broad column about the business world, and I can guarantee that I will continue to focus on the issue of lying. I mean, it's not going to go away. I think false statements by companies, by businesses, has enormous consequences. We haven't touched too much upon this, about what the consequences of lying, but certainly one of them are that that investors have lost billions of dollars because of false statements. And I guess the driving force of my column, as I see it, will be I'm there to stand up, certainly to hold people accountable for their own codes of conduct, to hold them accountable for obeying the law, and to stand up for individual investors and consumers in a world where too much of the economy seems to be dominated by giant institutions, investment banks, Wall Street, people with power and influence, whereas, in fact, capitalism and American democracy depend on the individuals having confidence and trust in the system.
Thank you very much. Our thanks to James Stewart.
Thank you. Thank you.
James Stewart is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author whose latest book is Tangled Webs, How False Statements Are Undermining America. He is a journalist and will soon be writing a column for the New York Times Saturday edition. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. Tonight's program has been a part of the Charles and Louise Travers series on ethics and accountability. I'm Professor Kirk Hansen, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.
I think you're a second-grade teacher.
Thank you.